Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Kurtwood Smith. You remember me from such TV comedies as That 70s Show and That 90s Show on Netflix. I'll never forget the words that my grandfather said just before he kicked the bucket. He said, "Watch how far I can kick this bucket." People ask me where I get my dad jokes from. I tell them to listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. Listen to Daily Dad Jokes every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Popcorn Book Club. I'm Dana Schwartz, joined as always by Melissa Hunter, Jennifer Wright, Tan Tran, and Karama Dankwa. And this week, we are a little bit late for the 5th of November, but unfortunately, right in time for the impending threat of totalitarianism. And we are talking V for Vendetta, the graphic novel written by Alan Moore, illustrated by David Lloyd.
God, Dana, classic. What an intro.
I know. It's sort of rolled off the tongue.
Way to set the tone.
It's the book, the graphic novel is divided into three parts. So we're going to do each episode part by part. So today we're just talking book one, which is like subheaded Europe After the Rain. Before we dive in,
to be clear, R-E-I-G-N, Rain.
Oh, yeah, Rain, yeah. Like the CW
Not
television
like
series.
Lady Gaga, Rain on Me. Like,
hey, Tian, are you gay?
Before we start, I'm curious because V for Vendetta has had such like a big part, like a big footprint in popular culture where even if you haven't like read it or seen it, you know, like the Guy Fawkes mask has become like the anonymous symbol. So, Jennifer, what has been your relationship with V for Vendetta before this podcast book reading?
Okay, well, I love V for Vendetta, but what I find fascinating is periodically I get like really hardcore Trump supporters who message me on Twitter, and I'm shocked by the number of them that have the V for Vendetta mask as their profile picture. Because if you read V for Vendetta, I think the first thing that happens is V beats up some corrupt cops who are going to rape a woman. So it's surprising to me that a group of very far right people have read this book and thought, yeah, this guy fighting against a fascist government where the police are an unbelievably corrupt force speaks
bold
to me.
Bold of you to assume they read the book.
Absolutely did not read the book. Thank you, girl.
Did they watch the movie? Because, like, it's still basically the same.
I mean, those are the same people that, like, misuse red pill and blue pill.
Also, the Punisher logo.
Oh, my yeah. God. They love Punisher. People with
they
white
love
trucks love Punisher decals. And you're like, what do you think that's communicating?
So, yeah, I love this book because I think it has overwhelmingly good social and moral values and is a dystopia about fascism in such a wonderfully realized way. And boy, people on the far right are not picking up on that.
It's also very funny to me because Guy Fawkes was an extreme Catholic. So that in and of itself is like interesting that he was like, yay, Catholicism. I don't like your Protestantism, that people who now adopt the Guy Fawkes mask are not like religious zealots. And again, it's an unambiguously anarchist symbol. So now that Donald Trump is like the incumbent leader and they're defending, they're like, oh, the anarchy in Portland. It's like, no, now you should specifically be in favor of that quote-unquote anarchy.
Yeah.
Melissa, thoughts?
Well, no, it just, I never thought about how even just in the past several years, I mean, since Trump became elected and is now a fucking loser, you know,
let's
there
just
was
take a moment to enjoy that together.
Okay, I do have to say,
wouldn't it suck if we had to be like a politically neutral podcast?
Like, obviously, well, let's see how long this lasts.
None of our thoughts or feelings.
Let's take a quick sidestep because I read these this first book before the election, and it made me feel really uncomfortable because it's, I mean, it's so immediately reflective of the Trump era of like Make Britain Great Again is on page 2. Mm-hmm. And and then I reread it last night or the 2 nights ago to like refresh my memory. And I just felt like a different, this is like right after Biden has gotten elected. And I just was able to read it and be like, ah, yes, that old thing. even though I know not everything is over, but it made me just feel so much better reading it post-election.
You know, I didn't want to bring up the political allegory too soon, but, and not to get into the movie yet, but now that we're sort of there, a thing that I always found interesting was that Alan Moore famously hates all adaptations of his work because he's like a crotchety old wizard. Like, that's just who he is.
But why does he let people adapt it then?
Yeah.
Because he does. Karama. Like, he always
houses.
Lets people Karama. Adapt it.
He likes houses. I don't know how many houses.
But he doesn't like them. He's like, you can do what you want, but I'm not going to like it. I'm telling
that's
you
that's fair.
Right? And he's
that's
always
fair.
Right.
And he I feel also, like I'll take that stance too in my future works.
He explicitly
I'm gonna adapt
was
a bunch
like,
of your shit and then be like, do you like it?
And I also think he doesn't take money. I'm pretty sure he says he just is like, I don't want the money.
Whoa,
I'm gonna check on that. Yeah.
Sorry,
back,
Alan
but like,
Moore. I didn't mean to.
No, he's like a weird wizard of the woods.
Does he know that he could give it away to good causes instead of letting movie studios keep it? I mean, not that they're not, in a way, a good cause. But, like, he could, you know, he could give it to, like, housing projects and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I like movies. I'm just saying movie studios are not the thing that I would first think of when I hear a good cause.
Yeah.
Well, or, like, we'll figure it out. I mean, I'm going to look up about whether he takes the money. But the point is, he hated the V for Vendetta movie, which we'll all watch and talk about, but he thought that they made it too American. And he's like, this is about England. It's not a metaphor about him, because it was happening during like the Bush era. And he thought that some like American Bush era politics crept into the movie. And he is like, nope, it's about Britain and England
well,
specifically.
Well, it's about Thatcher, and, right? Like,
yes.
Yeah, it's like, and like, he's like, and it's about anarchy and specifically anarchy. And if it's not about anarchy in Britain, it's not my book. But I do think, Melissa, your point is well made that this applies to a lot of situations and a lot of totalitarian governments in a way that maybe Alan Moore doesn't appreciate, but I think we can.
Yeah, it reminds me of Bong Joon-ho when he was talking about Parasite and how he wrote it specifically for a Korean audience, and then it became so wildly popular. And he's like, I guess we all live in the same country of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, ah,
yep. Yeah.
See, he gets it. Yeah, I mean, that's what's amazing about Alan Moore's work like this and Watchmen. You know, it's so relevant, unfortunately, you know, probably for decades and decades to come in all countries that are kind of resemble each other in certain ways, you know?
Karama, what was your V for Vendetta experience before the book club?
Well, I hadn't read it before, but I had seen the film many, 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 many times. One of my really good friends, Jose, shout out to Jose, loves Natalie Portman. So we watched a lot of Natalie Portman movies together, and this is one of them, and this is the one that I liked the most. So
she can have a fully bald head and still just be the most beautiful angel woman you have ever seen.
She is.
I feel like that's not that special, though. I think there are a lot of people who look good with bald heads, just but, not maybe a lot of white people.
That's true.
That's true. Well, and also, I will say, and I'm allowed to say this, not a lot of Jewish people. It's very rare that a Jew looks very good bald. We have weird egg-shaped heads. Anyway, Tien, what was your experience with V for Vendetta?
You know, I had never seen the films, and I only know, you know, that famous scene where she shaves her head and like, and all the mask wearing. I remember I did sketch comedy in Chicago at a place called Second City. And when we
heard of it.
Have you heard of it? On one of the stages, we took over a show, and the show before us had an opening that was very like themes of anarchy, themes of questioning authority. And the opening was them wearing these Guy Fawkes masks. And then like right before the scene changes, you have to like take them off and put them in a paper bag. So my experience with Guy Fawkes masks is trying to dance in the dark with this and then like clumsily fumbling, like trying to like put it in the bag before the lights come up, and you're like caught as the audience sees you like trying to stuff a Guy Fawkes bag into a paper bag while the scene is changing. So that is my experience with Guy Fawkes masks and V for Vendetta.
That's a pretty thorough. Yeah.
What would you sort of, I feel like before we do dive into the actual text, it is worth exploring that Guy Fawkes mask in popular culture. How would you describe the place that the Guy Fawkes mask has in popular culture?
Anonymous.
But I
feel like we had that good point with Trump where it's like, but now it's sort of like the counterculture. It's always like the counterculture thing that's like trolling, but almost just being a bad person on purpose.
Yeah, because I feel like some people think anarchy is coded by like literally holding up the status quo in the most obnoxious of ways. Is what I think that this mask sometimes, yeah. And some people have like taken that as a symbol of like, you know what? Everyone's talking about feminism. I'm going to be an asshole. My anarchy statement is to like push back on that. Like,
yeah, you can't being uphold the ruling system and yes, the government. Exactly.
Being an asshole for the status quo.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm gonna hurt a lot of people because they to protect this statue of my oppressor.
My experience with the Guy Fawkes mask, and I'm very embarrassed to say this. When I was in college, we put on a production of Sweeney Todd at the main stage of Brown University. And it was not just a production of Sweeney Todd. It was an Occupy Wall Street themed production of Sweeney Todd, every stereotype that like Tucker Carlson has about Brown University. It's like, oh, there was a giant McDonald's billboard as the backdrop and someone spray painted over it. Eat the rich. Like that was like subtext. That was subtext. You know, and during like the masquerade.
Some of it could have been subtext.
And during like the, you get it? Because in Sweeney Todd, they eat people.
Yeah, I got it.
And then during like the masquerade scene, which is like a flashback of Sweeney Todd's wife, there's a masked ball. And all of us in the ensemble as dancers were wearing Guy Fawkes masks.
And then she gets raped, Dana. Is that, that's what they wanted to project onto that?
The idea was that we, the students, were occupying the theater, putting on a production of Sweeney Todd.
Sure. Uh-huh.
So his wife gets raped. That's what happens at that party while everybody masks watch.
Production of Sweeney Todd, and we just happen to have those masks at the ready to use during the masquerade scene.
I feel like that's a perfect college production story. Like, I feel like every single one of us has one of those that we were like, this is going to absolutely blow everyone's minds. We have hit the nail on the head.
It reminded me, I did in college at Northwestern, a production of Brecht's Caucasian Chalk Circle. And, you know, it's very meta. And the director decided it's going to be in a circus tent. And she spent all of her money to put it in a circus tent on, like, Norris Lawn, which is right by the water. And it's supposed to be, like, because, like, society is a circus, you know, and all this stuff. And all of the budget went into that. And on the first night, it was in May, there was a classic May Chicago thunderstorm. And we were in a circus tent with lights and metal bleachers. And I was like, am I going to die for a production of Caucasian Chalk Circle? And everyone in the audience was looking like, are we going to die watching this student production of Caucasian Chalk Circle? And then thankfully,
luckily, like, someone called the dean's office or something, and it was shut down. And we had to do it in a conference room the rest of the time with carpet.
Oh,
I'm sorry. It was a nice idea.
No, that would have been a bad idea. Anyway, the complete aside, but Mike, if you want to cut out, you can.
No.
Please keep it in.
Very important.
Yeah. Well, I feel like theatricality is a big theme in V for Vendetta, which brings us to book one, in which we meet our two protagonists, Evie and V. Okay, I'm going to take a breather and prepare an elaborate set.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry though, he's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're listening and have read it or seen the movie, I'm going to give us to remind you, because we sort of have, you know, read all of them, what the beginning and the end of Act One is, so we can just sort of dive in so we all know. The beginning is obviously the beginning of the book. Evie is a young woman working in this new post-apocalyptic London, and she goes out to work her first night as a prostitute when she is accosted by Fingermen, who are like the secret police. We're going to get to the plot, but she meets V, who's like an anarchist revolutionary bon vivant, if you will. And
good
this
use of that.
The end of book one is we find out that V had been an inmate at a concentration camp testing facility called Larkhill, and that the series of murders that he had done in book one are all people who were in authority there. So the investigating detective, who's sort of maybe like the third main character, we have like V, Evie, and then Creedy, who's, is it Creedy? No, Finch. Sorry. Again, I made a cheat sheet of all the white guys because I kept losing track of their names. The third, maybe like of this triumvirate is the head of the nose of this Norse fire party, who's a guy named Finch, who's a detective trying to figure out who this terrorist is. And at the end of book one, Finch finds out that these murders are all people who were at Larkhill, and that maybe V is doing a vendetta, but maybe his vendetta is bigger than just Larkhill, and it extends beyond, and that's just a cover up.
Yeah,
That just to skip to the end real quick of this book, I feel like I was really enjoying it. And I'm not someone who reads, I don't read a lot of graphic novels. So this is like, it's almost retraining my brain to read this way. And it was kind of hard at first, I would say. But then I got really into it. And then I just love that final page of like, well, he might have been, you know, carrying out this vendetta on all these people, which is the optimistic theory. And I'm like, oh, shit. And it's like, or he's clearing the playing field to like set up some real shit. And I was like, oh, this is.
But that is right. It's very optimistic to think, oh, well, he's only attacking these few people unless he's laying the groundwork.
Yeah, it seems more likely that he's eliminated all of those people. Mm-hmm. He doesn't kill Lewis Prothero. He renders him incurably insane.
which is a very nice touch.
Yeah, touch. No, in a way that is so much scarier.
Mm-hmm. But, way scarier.
Yeah. But that means that none of the people who knew him in his previous identity are able to identify him anymore.
I thought that rendering Lewis Prothero, who is the voice of fate, who's the guy who does like the announcements for England on like a megaphone speaker through the town. So V knows he collects rare dolls and he like renders him insane using putting on like a little vaudeville performance with these creepy inmate dolls. Such a good use of the medium of a graphic novel, which is like using pictures, and like creepy dolls are creepy. And so it's always interesting to me to see like what translates really well to a graphic novel. And I feel like that really was effectively scary to me.
Oh yeah. And also seeing him like back at the police precinct or wherever he was like returned to, just saying mama, mama over and over again was very, very jarring and scary that, and also
I
felt
know
deserved.
What he saw exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's that scary thing where because we don't know what he sees, we can just fill in whatever's creepiest to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I found each way that V decides to dispatch these different people was also very interesting, especially Delia's, Dr. Delia's.
Yeah.
I thought that was just a great way to not so gently be like, even though you might be a good person, you were complicit in watching these terrible things happen and you didn't do anything about it.
And he's sort of an active participant.
An active participant too.
Yeah. It wasn't just that. She was like a citizen of the country who knew bad things were going on. She was giving people at a concentration camp
some kind
of disease that caused most of them to die horribly so she could work on a cure.
Totally.
But I do like that it gives V that moment of like killing her in a merciful way. And they sort of have that moment as peers, which is like almost as chilling to me as any of the murders. He just sort of like, we see like that he has a code of ethics in his own crazy mind. You know, like
he's like Dexter.
He's not like a joker. He's not like out doing things because he's crazy. He's like very methodical and like he knows that she's like kind of a good person. Yeah. Not
she
a good person.
She thought she could do something good. She was going about it in a horrifying way.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think complicit was not. I think like that she had a
hint of remorse.
She is, but she also, I think, maybe had like a hint of remorse more so than, say, Prothero, if that was his name.
Prothero.
Oh, yeah. He fucking sucks.
So, like, off with him.
Tian, I know you haven't seen the movie, but I'm so excited for you to see the movie. Like, I'm just so excited for you to see the movie.
I mean, I also don't read graphic novels. This is my first one ever. So like Melissa had said, I had to like kind of train my brain to the style of it. And I've been missing out. They are a delight.
Yeah. Alan Moore is just really great too. Like just really... I'm not a huge graphic novel person, but I really like all of Alan Moore's graphic novels.
Yeah. My slight, I am a big graphic novel person. I'm a big comic book person. My slight difficulty with this book at first, and it just took me a while and I got used to it, was like a lot of the middle-aged white dudes looked the same to me, and I just wanted them all to be wearing name tags.
That I'm also on that level. I just kind of accepted early on that I'm never going to know who's who, and I can use context clues to kind of figure out some of them, and that's okay with me. They don't need me to know who they are. They're not real people, it's fine. It's fine. That's kind of the point, I feel like. I feel like it was intentional that they were all drawn very similarly because they're all kind of the same. They're all kind of very just like shadowy bad guy in shadowy bad government. And I feel like that's kind of the reason that they are like that.
They're all sort of cogs in this, like, in this. One thing that was really interesting to me that I don't, again, want to compare it to the movie yet, but we do sort of get this like weird humanizing of these weird bureaucrats, and we find out they're like boring lives and their shitty marriages, which is almost scarier than just when bad guys are like Voldemort or just some like big bad, to like know that these people doing and upholding horrific systems are just like shitty, dumb dudes. They're just normal dudes.
I'm sorry, talking about shitty, incompetent dudes?
Indeed we are.
I'm in.
It makes me feel a little better, kind of, like to see Almond, who, if I remember correctly, not to compare it to the movie, but was not in the movie, but like was kind of really shitty in the book. To see him, like, not to see him beating his wife, that makes me feel better. But seeing him die after seeing him beat his wife, I'm kind of like, maybe this V guy is onto something. I feel like he's not wrong. He's not necessarily right, but he's not wrong.
He is very, another thing that Alan Moore criticized the movie for is he's like, V isn't just about overthrowing a totalitarian government. He is in favor of anarchy. That is the system of government that he wants. I, Dana Schwartz, if I was, picking a government system, wouldn't go anarchy. But I think that V as a character is incredibly interesting and compelling.
Yeah, I haven't seen the movie yet, but I know. It's very exciting.
I'm so excited.
It's so good. Yeah. This is one movie where, again, we'll get to it. Personally, I feel like it makes effective changes to work as a movie. And really works as a movie.
And seeing it kind of in reverse, reading this for the first time after having seen the movie so many times, I'm like, oh, no disrespect to Alan Moore, but this is actually a pretty decent adaptation. Oh,
cool. You gotta tighten. You gotta make it be like, where's the 2-hour thing?
But there are some characters that are clearly cut out of the movie that I had basically forgotten about and I loved revisiting. Mary is obviously like a lovely woman, very sympathetic in this book. I'm obsessed with Helen Heyer. Just to jump past talking about Mary for a second. Helen Heyer, who seemingly only wears a fur coat and has like platinum white ice queen hair, and introduces herself by being an unbelievable bitch to her husband. And then when Mary's like, oh, she's quite hard on him, isn't she? Her husband turns to her and is like, you'll never be as cool as her. Never.
Rosemary, right?
Oh, yes, Rosemary. Sorry, yeah.
Which one is Rosemary? I'm blanking.
Yeah. She's Almond's wife, right?
She's Almond's wife.
Rosemary.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's abused by her husband. And,
Rosemary is a major character in the graphic novel who's cut out of the film. But she is...
Yeah, she's straight gone.
Which I think is effective because the movie is making different points. But in the novel, to trace Rosemary's journey, she is the wife of Almond, who's the head of the finger policeman, and he's really abusive to her. And she's kind of like meek and like, okay, this sucks. And then, again, jumping forward, I'm losing track a little bit because we're just talking about book one now, but jumping forward a little bit, Almond is murdered. She being
in
a widow in book one.
And
being a widow without very many options, she starts dating the head of the mouth, Dascombe, Roger Dascombe, who's like the propaganda guy. And then she'll sort of continue on a downward spiral, sort of like, a symbol for a lot of things. But Helen Heyer...
We'll get into that more in the other book.
We'll get into that more in book two. And Helen Heyer, we're going to get way more into in book three, because that's when we figure out who the hell she is.
Yeah. I can't wait.
Oh, I'm excited.
I like the level of different experiences that we have with this one. I feel like it's like a nice mélange, you know?
Well, let's jump in. Book one, we're introduced to Evie, who's starting as a prostitute on her first night. What do we 16 make?
16-year-old prostitute.
16-year-old prostitute. Karama,
first-timer.
What do you make of a first-timer Evie?
Well, I think that she's a really great, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Surrogate for the reader. Because she seems very innocent. She has experience with the world that we're in, and she's not unaware of what the system is, but she's still so young and kind of naive that it feels like it makes sense for people to explain things at her and to see things through her eyes. And like, obviously we get different perspectives from this, but I think that Evie's a great intro to the world, and we see the finger police, and that's how we meet V also, because she is so naive and like very bad at prostituting that she's kind of like, yo,
she put on her makeup
sex, and he's like, you're not great at this, and she's like, I'm 16, it's my first time. I felt very relatable in that moment, because I feel like I too would be very bad at like a street walking type deal.
She's like crying. It's like, it's not, it's hard.
It's embarrassing. It's awkward to be like, would you want to, you know, pay and also have sex with me? It's hard enough to ask a guy if they want to have sex with you and not if they want to pay. but of course, this is the moment. She's very bad. She's very bad at being a prostitute because she propositions a secret undercover cop. And she is rescued by the very theatrical V, who visually, you know, using a graphic novel visually, it's very interesting because as we see Evie getting ready, the very next panel is sort of V getting ready in his mirror, and he's putting on his mask and hair and hat, we assume, before he...
A lot of props and costumes for a anarchist. I'm just thinking in terms of, like, logistics, movement, fighting ability.
A lot of planning.
Really nice house, too.
Pre-fascism, he definitely was a theater major and did direct in a circus tent.
Oh, yeah, for sure. 100%. I have more thoughts about that next week when we talk about book two. But I'll get into that.
Well, book one, we can talk about he loves like a flash bomb, and then he built the entire scale model of Larkhill to drive that guy crazy.
What I want to know is like where's all this production budget coming from? Like with the all the different masks, all the dolls, all the he took
the National Endowment for the Arts. That's where all their money goes.
My thinking is maybe V when they were in theater when he was in theater school was like. Stage manager production, because that's so how he can build props. Everything.
It's like the back of UCB, like that's where he is. Maybe he's at the UCB of their world. Maybe that is where the hideout is.
He could have
Alan
taken
Moore would
it.
Be very disappointed that we're making this so American right now.
My logistical question is he's growing fancy roses, and his hideout his hideout is underground. How do you grow roses underground? Where's he getting all these sun lamps?
Getting scale models of concentration camps. Like, I feel like it's easier to get a sun lamp than a scale model of a concentration camp that no one knows existed.
He's definitely on some kind of soundstage. It's got to be with that scale.
With that, and he's got good lighting. He, like, is lighting the camps in the great
way. He's got
a
couple stage hands for sure. Yeah. They're, like, putting the follow spot on him, you know?
I think it's very funny to me to imagine the 6 weeks that went into him building and sewing the costumes alone, like sweating, before we see just the end results.
I would love a book zero that's just him doing all the prep and running his lines.
Yes, running his lines. Like,
nope, I need a line. It's anti-fascism. Thank you, Carl. Yeah, you just gotta keep going. Gotta work through it.
That's so much prep.
Live
truly,
theater, baby.
Every single part of his like presentation, the way he kills, the way he moves about. There's just so much prep to it.
He's like an anime villain. He just like loves the drama. The part that I was like, wow, he prepped this because this is just for him, is he gives that speech to Lady Justice, the statue, and he gives a speech that he definitely, a monologue that he definitely wrote. And then he delivers.
But he plays both parts.
And then
he like karaoke'd Nelly Furtado, Timbaland, promiscuous girl to
oh
that.
Oh my gosh,
just.
Marry me, Tian.
And then he deposits his bomb at her feet, and it's shaped like a box of chocolates. He doesn't know that we're watching a graphic novel of him. He thinks that he made this box bomb and tied the bow and cut it and made it look nice just for it to blow up for no one, just him. He's not posting it to his anarchy Instagram.
The CSI people who have to come and analyze it later.
It's blown up. Well, they're not going to see it.
You still like, get remnants, and they're like, ooh, ribbon. Where could he have bought this ribbon? Like, have you never seen CSI? I don't know. Maybe I just watch a lot of CSI.
I'm sorry, I don't watch America's number one show.
As someone who now feels like I have the weird chip in my brain that anytime I do something, I need to like take a picture of it and post it on social media to prove that I exist, where it's like there is something very sweet about him just like doing all this for him. No one's going to see it. No one's going to appreciate it. He just cares about the work.
I feel like you should try that.
To me, it feels like he has a lot of time on his hands.
But people are going to see it. I mean, it blew up. Like,
not the speech, not the details.
Yeah, not the speech or the beautiful little box of chocolates that he put the bomb in. It feels like nobody has this much time. And I think it plays into the kind of magic of V, because there's like a Martha Stewart element to all of these actions. Like, there's a lot of preparation going into everything that I don't think you would have if you also had to dismantle a fascist government.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I could see a cooking video of V making the communion host with cyanide. Just like a beautiful YouTube.
Making
chef's
crackers
video.
Is hard.
It's hard.
Well, what's wild to me about all of this is that this was the 80s. So how did he know how to do everything? He had to just know. He can't walk into a library.
A book. He stole all these books, right? And all these movies. Right.
And he was in, when he was in his room 5, he stole a bunch of books and was just reading up on how to cook communion wafers, how to grow roses.
But that's the thing. What if you don't have the right books? Do we think he's limited by the books that he had when he was in?
Yes. I think that's it. I think all of it is based on, well, I have these eight skills. One of them is making communion wafers. Like, how do I make it work in my vendetta?
And I think that's exactly it. He got these specific books and then built his vendetta only around the things he did.
Yes.
100%. Yes.
How even does one make a communion wafer? I'm Googling communion wafer.
They're very thin.
But it's also got to be pretty easy. I mean, there's Catholics eat so many of those every week, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
They're manufactured for sure.
And it doesn't have to taste good. I mean,
they don't taste good. They taste like nothing.
I've never had one.
It's bizarre.
I've never had one either.
It truly tastes like less than nothing.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that it tastes less than nothing.
I feel like it's rude to not make Jesus taste good. Like, is that sacrilegious to say? Like, if you're going to stick some Jesus in your mouth, I feel like it should taste like, hey, yeah, Jesus, tasty. And then,
I feel like if you really believe in transubstantiation and you really believe that it's Jesus's body, you don't want to think about it that much.
You want it to taste like
you associate like chocolate chip cookies with eating Jesus's flesh, you know?
Or like have like meat. You don't want it to be too literal. You don't want it to be like meat.
Like,
and
chicken.
Then you're like, ah.
Yeah.
But maybe that's why I'm not religious.
That, like, if you get in different lines, you can get different. Like, okay,
or it's
that
just
one
a
over
piece
there is garlic
salami.
Parmesan. Line,
hold on a sec. I'm just really quick going to Google some recipes for church wafers.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts Gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry, though. He's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
After V rescues Evie from the rapey fingermen who were going to rape and murder her because of this fascist totalitarian government. But also, I think important, violence against women is also an indicator of a lot of extremist ideology. Mm-hmm. So that at least felt unfortunately anchored. But mm-hmm. V rescues her and brings her down to his hideaway. And she tells him sort of her story, which we'll get to, which is some like exposition about this world. And he asks her to help. And one of the ways that she helps him is by dressing up as a child prostitute to sleep with Bishop Anthony Lilliman, who's like the Westminster bishop. And she's going to, open the window for V to come in and kill him in a dramatic way.
It visually made me think of Killing Eve, which is funny because it's Evie. If V and Evie were one person, it would be a Killing Eve scene. Like how she's in this very elaborate costume and just like going out of her way to kill him in a creative way, but then V does it and she's actually terrified. Anyway, that's my cultural touchstone.
V is a theater major who takes one poli sci class. That's what it feels like to me.
And philosophy 101.
Oh, and philosophy, yes.
And all the straight girls on this pod or have had sex with him and regretted it.
100%.
Or bi as well.
Yeah. Nope. Yeah. Would have done it.
As someone who is not Christian in any way, but I'm like very fascinated by like Christian symbolism and like idea. Like it's very like beautiful and spooky to me. And I kind of like, I love that imagery. So like I loved and was very spooked by like the juxtaposition of like V sneaking into this abbey with like the text was like, we ask in the name of like the Father and Son or like whatever, like, which might be very mundane to someone who is Catholic. But like to me as someone, those are still spooky words. I'm just like, ah.
Oh, yeah, the whole like as I walk through the valley of the, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It is very spooky.
Scary. It's scary.
Christianity, it's like on the cross in every church, there's a Jesus like bleeding from it and dying on a friggin' crucifix, you know, that is very dark
and very theatrical.
The crosses in the church don't scare me as much as the fact that people wear it on necklaces. Yes. That for me is a mind warp where you're just like, wait a second, there's like a dead dude on your neck. You realize that
it's a dead
dude that's also like usually kind of cut too. Like they always see Jesus like have abs while he's dying, which is just a real.
Can I say cum gutters in relation to Jesus?
No, I don't. I thought it, but I was like, I'm not going to say it because it's going to make people angry.
Please don't.
What is that?
That's
Melissa,
the V.
It's the cum gutter.
It's the V.
Oh my God, I did not know that is what that is called.
It's another V.
It's the V.
I'm mortified.
Thank God my parents don't listen to this podcast.
My dad just said he was going to start listening. Sorry, Dad.
Sorry, Mom.
Wait, I'm sorry. Wait, I have to step back now.
Yeah.
Cum gutters because
it's
there's
the
literally no logical reason. Yeah, like I've thought about it a lot in the last week and it doesn't make sense.
Wait, no, gutter. Are you no, because if you come it's erect and then it drips down gutters. Don't make me explain this, you gross
okay,
people.
Now I see.
I just said it. I didn't want to explain it.
But like
Mike, cut it all out.
I had to also
in relation to Jesus. Just the best part of it. Thanks, Dana. Just want to make sure to clarify. That was Dana who brought it up.
Dana definitely said that.
Okay, well, now I'm going to let me redeem myself really fast by then making and then Karama.
Only Jesus can redeem you.
By just making it a very smart point that I'm going to make is that theatricality historically was a major power of the Catholic Church, and that was its authority over the people. Like, the Catholic Church was all about imagery and really striking stained glass and portraits and the Latin mass and song and the smell, hangy smells. I'm Jewish. I'm so sorry.
No. I'm such a shitty person for laughing at that.
No, it was the hand motion.
You know what I'm talking about. There's the thing.
We know exactly what you're talking about. And I think that a point is that first, I was a theater major in college and most of my performance theory class, we talked about Christianity and how theater, theatricality, and performance developed in the Catholic Church. And like Christmas Mummer plays and Corpus Christi's and how they would travel around because there were so many people that wanted to see the elevation of the host. They had to take it out of the church because people would like go church hopping to see as many elevations as possible because they're like, that's how I'm getting into heaven, which... I don't think that's how it works. I think you have to also
the more nice you see, then you're in heaven.
But why not hedge your bets? But what I was going to say, the other thing is, this is so dumb and it's not as bad as the thing that Dana said.
Which is also a very important and smart point.
But in the beginning of the music video for Helena by My Chemical Romance, they sort of open it up with the hangy smelly thing, and like that level of theatricality and the attraction of like the church and the they're like very strong, powerful symbols. And I like the way that in this fascist society they use that, and they have this like lecture that the priest, that's the word, priest is giving, and he's talking about how it's sort of like the priest and the voice of fate work in tandem. Mm-hmm. And they together tell everybody how to make Britain great and keep Britain great and how they should work together. And I think it's interesting that Britain in specific, which I think is to Alan Moore's point, is that they have not a separation of church and state the way that we do in the United States.
The way that we say we do.
Correct. The way that we claim we do. That is a very smart and important point. But like, they're not even pretending. They have the Anglican Church. The whole thing with the royal family is that they have been chosen by God.
They're the head of the church.
Yeah. And so I think it's really interesting how that works and how it's sort of like using their tools against them, the theatricality that V uses to then overthrow them.
He also sort of does the thing like a Batman villain where he like leaves clues on purpose. Like, he specifically breeds these rare roses that can, if someone is smart, can trace this rare breed back to Larkhill where he was. And he specifically then leaves the diary visible with Delia, who's the doctor. That's why it's so chilling at the end that, like, Finch is like, well, maybe, you know, this, we hope this is just his vendetta, but maybe the vendetta is covering up something bigger. Like, he is doing the Batman villain thing of like, yeah, I'm the Riddler. I'm leaving you the fucking clues of who I am and what I'm doing because the theatricality is part of his power. He wants to like thrill and excite the people of England with like him as a symbol. He wants to turn himself into a symbol.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I thought was fascinating is that there's an offhand mention on the radio that the royal family still exists. The princess is out and she's wearing a lovely salmon-colored frock. Mm-hmm. And I think that is part of the theatricality of England, that it's something we don't have here, that you have these people that kind of performatively try to embody the English spirit. Hmm. And where are they? What are they doing? How do they live in this completely fascist country now? What is the season of the crown like in V for Vendetta?
You know, I hate to do the Hitler comparison, but Hitler comparison. I also do this history podcast called Noble Blood, shout out. And I did an episode about Crown Prince Wilhelm, who was the son of the last Kaiser, Kaiser Wilhelm mm-hmm. the First.
Oh, yeah.
And when Hitler was building a fascist government and claiming power, it was really important for him to have Crown Prince Wilhelm like by his side wearing a Nazi uniform to like legitimize the government. So this is like, this is Germany. This is our government. It's a continuation of power. Mm-hmm. So it totally makes sense in a historical way that maybe even Alan Moore was going for, that like a fascist government would be like, and yes, the British royal family continues. This is just a continuation of Britain being made great. We are not a separate thing that mm-hmm. overthrew Britain. Mm-hmm. We are Britain.
Well, and it is, sorry, Alan Moore, I'm going to compare it to modern day America. It is so funny. That's what's so funny to me about Donald Trump, like pre-election, is that he was so desperately trying to find celebrities that would be like mm-hmm. on his side or like come up, and it ended mm-hmm. up being like Lil Pump, I think, was the last one before the end. And like, it just felt like a wannabe fascist dictator was trying to do that. But in America, most our celebrities royalty. Hate you. They are royalty. Yeah. They are royalty.
Oh, yeah. As soon as Jen was talking about the royal family, I was like, what do you mean we don't have a royal family? Yeah, we have the Knowles Carters. What are you talking about? I know, Beyonce is the queen.
Yeah. I once in an airport, when I was going through customs coming back from London, it was in LA. I was behind this couple with two little kids, and it was like a 8-year-old and girl and a 6-year-old boy, and the girl said, "Do you know this is where Queen Beyonce lives?"
Oh my god!
Oh, that's very nice.
Okay, that's awesome.
Yeah, and I was like, "You're right. That is where Queen Beyonce lives."
I'm gonna say slightly back to V for Vendetta. Good for Alan Moore for breaking the stereotype that priests are gay pedophiles and just making the priest just a regular pedophile.
Oh, yeah.
what foresight,
Well, something
Alan.
That seems important about all of the people that we see really up close is they're supposed to represent this hyper-masculine, religious, classic conservative model, and none of them do. Like, Prothero is the voice of the nation, and he is obsessed with dolls, which...
I love
you know,
the dolls.
Nothing wrong mm-hmm. with being obsessed dolls. With dolls, but it's not, like, a hobby I think John Wayne probably had.
But I bet like Lindsey Graham does.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's the same. I think you can see that a lot with Donald Trump as well, that I do not think of him as being particularly masculine. He wears makeup and is very obsessed with his appearance. He's very worried about like people criticizing him or lies about his weight. Like a lot of things that I just don't think of hyper-masculine people is doing or worrying about. And we see that with all of these characters in this book as well. Like, they love dolls or they're, like, a pedophile.
Creep,
or Derek Almond, I guess, is completely enthralled to Helen Hayer, my favorite moment of the book, where he just talks about how his wife will never be as cool as her because she's such a mean bitch.
Shut up,
so
Rosemary.
Awesome.
Wish you were Helen Hayer.
Yeah.
I mean, Dana, you have the cheat sheet.
Yeah.
Who was the female doctor? What's her name?
Her name is Delia Sturridge.
Delia. I loved that whole sequence because I felt like, you know, you see all the other ones and they're all fighting and they're all very, all of them are equally culpable, particularly Delia. But I loved seeing one of the characters, like she has been eaten away by guilt and fear and shame and is just ready to die. Like, cause she felt like this was always coming, whether out of her own guilt or just out of like knowledge of consequences. And I thought that was the best scene, like in the buildup that was the last kill was really a powerful scene, I thought.
She also seemed smart in the way that the men that V kills didn't, that she understood what was happening. She's like, it's you. I know what's happening. Good.
I was going to say something along similar lines where I think it's interesting that the only person who feels any level of remorse that we at least get to see shown is also the only person who's like, of course this is going to come back to get me and is also a woman. And I think that that's, I think that it's, I'm not saying all women in government are good. I mean, Margaret Thatcher, right off the bat, not necessarily my idol as a hashtag strong woman, but, I think it's interesting to see that empathy in this story, at the very least, comes through mostly from the women in power.
Yeah.
There aren't that many. There's but Delia.
But that it is interesting, like, I mean, that you can be this woman with empathy, this person with empathy, and still get sucked into wanting to be in a position of power, being close to power, and using it against other people. So I think I mean, I love all of the complexities of that and Delia in particular.
And especially because with the people that they are subjugating in this camp, like a lot of conversations are being had right now about like the percentage of white women that continue to vote for Trump and how white women benefit more from white supremacy than they do from intersectional feminism. And part of that is that like you attach yourself, if you have multiple privileged identities, you attach yourself to the one that gives you the most privilege. And in this case, it's whiteness. And it's really interesting to see that she is a straight white woman and they are subjugating people of color and queer people at these camps. So she's like, well, you know, yeah, I'm a woman and I have empathy, but also like, we don't need these undesirables.
I think she does justify to herself, not that I think she, in, again, not to defend her because she's like an indefensible member of this totalitarian party, but I think she thinks it is bad that the government is locking up queer people and people of color, but they are, can't help it, going to use this to my advantage and do some medical tests that I'm curious about. She's exploiting the situation.
Shout out to another podcast that Dana turned me on to, You're Wrong About, which you were also on. There was a several part on the Tuskegee syphilis study. And that made me think of this. And I wonder if that was an inspiration for it, because it is all of these justifications.
Melissa, that took place in America. This is a British story.
I was going to say.
Nothing could be relevant.
Sure Britain,
Hitler got a lot of ideas from America.
That's true. That might have been like life imitating art, imitating life. I don't know. Like, but maybe, like, maybe the thing is,
I'm sure that British people had their own shit that they did to like probably Indian people or something, because they did a whole bunch of shitty stuff to Indians.
Yeah, maybe the scientists at the Tuskegee experiment were like, oh, these Brits had a great one where they just
The
secretly
Boer War is actually a perfect example of that.
Can you explain? I don't know that.
During the Boer War, a lot of people were put into concentration camps, and the Britons decided that rather than contain any diseases that were ravaging through those camps, they would just let the diseases explode unchecked. And it wouldn't lower the morale of the soldiers because they wouldn't have to kill them up close. They just put them in really, really close quarters. And they just let everyone who got sick stay with everyone else. And it's considered a very notable instance of genocide. Like, that's still genocide if you make or allow people that you have control over to remain sick, and they die as a result. That's
yeah.
A
kind I mean, of
genocide.
That's
also a lazy genocide. Like, if you're gonna kill people, kill them.
I'm sorry.
I'm not saying we should kill people, but I'm just saying, like, it's so rude to be like, I'm just gonna let you die.
We're not gonna give you medicine.
At least
ever.
Do the V for Vendetta thing and come up with like an elaborate and fun, dramatic way to kill someone. If you're gonna kill someone, you have to come up with a whole theme.
Have a sense of
build,
style.
Build a set.
Have a point of view.
I already regret saying that, but like, what I mean is, it feels like there's something that these people are saying you're not even worth the effort of actually exterminating you. And that is adding insult to injury in my eyes. Like, I'm not saying anyone should kill people, but I do feel like it's almost more offensive to me that it's like, we're just gonna let them hang out together and get sick off each other. And we'll just see what happens.
I mean, that was what I think is so like, not the only thing, but an element of what was so awful about like the Tuskegee experiment, where there was just this idea like, well, they have syphilis anyway. They probably aren't going to get treatment. So
let's just not tell them that they have syphilis. But also in that it was bad. It was lazy science too. Yeah. In that like they didn't take down, they like lost track of some of the people they were doing this horrible thing to. And we're like, whoops, we lost a few. And like, just they did the science. There was no science there. It was super lazy. It's like most people who are evil are also lazy.
It just shows like a complete disregard of human life and like that white supremacy, that racism of just like, well, whatever.
Well, cause I think it's also, exactly. It's rooted in like the white supremacy and the thinking of like biological superiority. So like it's like you're letting these people, they're getting sick on their own accord because they're just not strong
because
enough to fight it. Like they're just not strong enough to fight it off. So, and to go back to the book, Delia is, she comes in and says that in her diary, she says that like, She starts looking at people and like seeing people of color and queer people. She's like, oh, I started to be like disgusted by them. Like, she's a bitch.
She's a racist
I mean,
person.
If she doesn't go in there incredibly racist, she is incredibly racist very quickly.
Those systems are also designed to dehumanize the people and like totalitarian government and racism, racist systems work by, you know, indoctrinating the people. And so it's like, what's that thing? Cognitive dissonance, where it's like, she has to treat these people in a certain way. So your brain is like, well, yeah, then they're disgusting.
I will say, I think it's interesting that what ends up being their downfall is their sort of infantilization of these patients. And they're like, oh, it's so cute how the guy in room 5 has a little pile of stuff.
little piles of bomb stuff. What's going on?
Why the little piles of like chemicals? Did no one see that coming?
I would have immediately been like, wait, no, there's a plan here. And she even says, I think there's like a little method to his madness. He's so sweet. He's so fun. And like treating him like a child or a pet, where it's like, oh, this is cute. It ends up being the thing that gets their shit blown up. Like, they really underestimated him.
I mean, I think they have oppress these people so much that they've forgotten that these people are capable of hating them. That if you have a system where people are not allowed to look you in the eyes or talk to you, and then there's one who can like grow flowers, you've at that point you've forgotten that that is a very dangerous human being who probably hates you.
Can I ask before we close out, what do you make of Evie and V and their relationship and how they interact with each other and how he interacts with her?
I was gonna say, I really do like the way that Delia is like a nuanced female character. Alan Moore is obviously a man. He wrote this in, I think, the 80s. I don't love like the daddy issues stuff with
Oh, yeah, he's obviously her dad.
I did not.
It's like, all right, that's whatever. I mean, I think that she is more of a conduit to the story than a character. And so I find it a little uncomfortable when they like, I don't know, or like lazy when they're like, oh, the 16-year-old has daddy issues because her dad, the socialist, was murdered by the fascist government. How dare she have normal issues because of that?
Look, I think if we can accept that the second Mrs. De Winter wanted a murder daddy, we can also accept that Evie wants a murder daddy.
Oh my gosh, so many. We have a theme.
Oh, they all love murder daddies.
They all love murder daddies.
She wants a murder daddy, but she does not herself want to murder. And I do think that that is something that's interesting. Yeah. Her insistence that she's like, I don't want to be a part of this. I have no desire to inflict pain on others, even though I've been in a shitty situation because of this government. Like, mm-hmm. they almost killed her. And even with mm-hmm. that, she was like, you used me to kill somebody and you didn't tell me. And it brings up a really interesting thing about consent. She didn't consent to be in this government system, but she also didn't consent to overthrow it in this way. And I thought that was really interesting.
That's really well said. Well, I think on that note, and one more thing I wanted to add, another problem that Alan Moore had with the film adaptation was that he didn't think that they went far enough in on the themes of white supremacy and racism within totalitarian regimes. And I think that is a theme that was very important to him. And I think definitely comes out very quickly in book two called The Vicious Cabaret. So on that note, we'll hear you next week, or you'll hear us next week. Jesus Christ.
We can hear you guys when you listen.
What did we not tell you? Fascism, baby.
That's our show for the week. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Dana Schwartz, and you can find me on Twitter at Dana Schwartz with 3 Z's. You can follow Jennifer Wright at Jen Ashley Wright. Karama Danqua is at Karama Drama. Melissa Hunter is at Melissa FTW. And Tian Tran is smart enough to have gotten off Twitter, but she is on Insta at Hank Tina. Our executive producer is Christopher Hesiodis, and we're produced and edited by Mike Johns. Special thanks to David Wasserman. Next week, we continue our November discussion of V for Vendetta, the graphic novel, with book two, This Vicious Cabaret. Popcorn Book Club is a production of iHeartRadio.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Races. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Hey, I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go, right? There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. On NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's part existential deep dive and part game show. I ask actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to ask some of life's biggest questions. Listen to NPR's Wildcard on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Kurtwood Smith. You remember me from such TV comedies as That 70s Show and That 90s Show on Netflix. I'll never forget the words that my grandfather said just before he kicked the bucket. He said, "Watch how far I can kick this bucket." People ask me where I get my dad jokes from. I tell them to listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast. Listen to Daily Dad Jokes every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.